Professors Branswood and Ewing, who are both Professors of Law at King's College London. We're starting with Professor Ewing, so I will mention that she has been in the UK since 1993 when she came over as a Rhodes Scholar. She is Professor of Law at King's College since September 2006, after having been at Oxford University for 12 years. Her research explores the ways in which law, alongside many other policy instruments, is used to shape and constrain social behaviour.
Thanks, Rachel. It's a privilege to be here this afternoon. My job in this presentation is simply to whet your appetite, if it hasn't been wet already by our two previous speakers, to introduce some of the issues that arise in the contemporary information society in relation to privacy, data processing, and confidentiality. And I want to open our presentation by giving you a set of three different stories, all of which have appeared in the British media over the last couple of weeks. And the first one will be of interest to those of you who are responsible for hiring staff, or you have been responsible for hiring staff, and you face the challenge of assessing the honesty and integrity of job applicants. Well, soon, very soon, there will be a simple way in which you can check up on job applicants, because later this month, the National Staff Dismissal Register is expected to go live. This register is an online database of workers accused of theft and dishonesty, which potential employers can access when vetting job applicants. It will contain records of individuals accessible online via an encrypted password system, and all of the information will be kept for a 5-year period on each individual, which can include photos. Well, this register is an initiative of the Action Against Business Crime, a partnership with the Home Office and the British Retail Consortium. It was set up by a Surrey-based firm, Highcom Business Solutions, and it will allow employers to search for potential workers by name, address, date of birth, national insurance number, and previous employer. Well, Highcom proudly says that a number of major companies have already signed up to the scheme, including Harrods, Selfridges, Reed Managed Services, and Mothercare. So that means that by the end of the month, employers who have signed up to this register will be able to check whether job applicants have been dismissed or whether they have resigned from the company whilst under suspicion of allegations of stealing, forgery, fraud, damaging company property, or causing a loss to their employers or suppliers. And details of individuals can be included on this register regardless of whether they have been convicted of any offence or indeed even prosecuted. And it appears, at least on my reading of the company's literature, that individual details can be placed on this register even if there has been no internal disciplinary proceeding that establishes whether or not a disciplinary offence has been committed against the employer. Well, I'll be surprised if many of you have heard of this register, because it actually hasn't attracted very much publicity. But not surprisingly, trade unions and civil liberties campaigners have objected on the basis that it leaves workers vulnerable to the threat of false accusations with inadequate protection. Well, in response, Highcom says that it will limit access only to those employers who comply with the Information Commissioner's Employment Practices Code, and that when people apply for jobs, they'll be told that this database will be consulted. So there's nothing to fear, says Highcom. Well, my second story, or set of stories, appears rather different, although there is some similarity in the first. Because the first vignette of this set of four stories refers to the establishment of a social networking site, which is based in America, called don'tdatehimgirl.com. And as the name suggests, it's actually also a database, and apparently this database, don'tdatehimgirl.com, contains the profiles of over 46,000 men. I'm told that 10% of those are British too, by the way. It's not just American men contained on this database. Many of these individual profiles of individual men have been, not surprisingly, posted in anger by their former lovers, keen to name and shame individuals and to warn others against getting romantically involved with them. But posting details of your former lover on a social networking site is simply one of a number of different forms of contemporary practice that have been labelled e-venge. So, for example, in another case, a man posted his ex-girlfriend's contact details on a web chat forum about pop stars, saying that it was the contact number for a well-known teenage pop group. Not surprisingly, she received thousands of telephone calls at all hours of the day, and she was forced to change her number because that was all these would-be fans ringing up to try and speak to her. Well, even more creatively is this woman here, who in fact is a British actress, and she put together a 6-minute video which she uploaded to YouTube. And on this video, she spent 6 minutes deriding her husband, her rather high-profile American husband, for a range of alleged shortcomings, including his sexual performance, after allegedly being threatened with divorce and eviction from the family home. Well, her husband might well seek the services of a company recently started up in America by a businessman aptly labelled Reputation Defender. And Reputation Defender specialises in online firefighting, and it offers to search out and destroy everything on the web that threatens disgrace to you or your family, charging anything from $10 a month to $250,000 per engagement. Well, on a more serious note and closer to home, my third and final story appears, at least superficially, rather different. This concerns a young man, and this is not him in fact, who in 2005 was a press officer for an organisation known as the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, which, as its name suggests, opposes arms exports. Well, in his capacity as a member of this organisation, he attended the annual general meeting held in a London hotel of Reed Elsevier, an academic publisher, which had recently purchased a company which organised arms fairs, along with other shareholders and some other members of CAAT. Now, prior to the AGM, CAAT had liaised with the Metropolitan Police, and it was agreed with the police that two representatives would leaflet shareholders as they were going into the meeting at the hotel. But no other demonstration took place. And indeed, during the meeting, several shareholders raised questions of the board about its decision to acquire this small business that organised arms fairs. Well, when the meeting was over, Mr. Wood got up and left with his colleague from the CAAT, and on the way out of the hotel, he stopped to talk to one of the other members of CAAT who was distributing leaflets. All the while, the police were taking photographs of members of the public who had been attending the meeting, and it was at that stage that they noticed that Mr. Wood was in fact somehow associated with this organisation, and they started openly taking photographs of him. Well, their interest in this young man was triggered, having worked out that association, so they started following Mr. Wood and his colleague as they proceeded to the nearest tube station. And they stopped Mr. Wood and his colleague and asked them some questions, but Mr. Wood explained politely that he had done nothing unlawful and he was simply going to proceed on his way to the tube station. All the while, the police continued to take photographs. They followed them in person on foot all the way into the tube station, and it was only when these two young men went to the station platform that the surveillance ended. Well, Mr. Wood wasn't very happy about this. He wasn't very happy about the photographs, and he wasn't very happy about the fact that the police were compiling a dossier on him, particularly when he had acted perfectly lawfully and he had not even been arrested because there was nothing suspicious about his behaviour. So 2 weeks ago, Mr. Wood brought a judicial review action in the High Court challenging the legality of the taking of the photographs and the compiling of information about him, even though he was not arrested, nor did he break the law in any way. The High Court has heard the application and we're expecting a decision on this anytime this week. Well, on the face of it, these three stories perhaps don't reveal anything particularly unusual, let alone revolutionary. For example, the setting up of the National Staff Dismissal Register can be seen as a way of simply expediting the process of checking the references of job applicants. And rather than having to employ the old-fashioned means of picking up the telephone and having a chat about a potential employee, the new employer can simply check up on an online database. The second set of vignettes can simply be seen as contemporary manifestations of human responses to an age-old phenomenon, the desire to kiss and tell in order to seek revenge on one's former partners who have left them feeling angry and broken-hearted. And indeed, the third story doesn't involve any high technology at all. It's simply photography and surveillance of the old-fashioned kind. But there is nonetheless a direct link between these three stories, for they all demonstrate the changing social practices, conventions and expectations about what information counts as private and what does not, and the potential for modern information technologies radically to alter our understanding of what informational privacy means and what it demands. So, for example, it's true that it's always been open to a prospective employer seeking advice about job applicants to ring up a previous employer. But the truth of the matter is that if it's possible to consult a national online database, it's not only much more likely that potential employers will make these kinds of checks, but it's also highly likely that such a database would be treated by employers as authoritative, even in situations where there's considerable dispute about whether or not any dishonesty allegations were genuine or well-founded, rather than simply a product of an employer's personal animosity towards an employee. But it seems that the protection that the register is offering to individuals who are unhappy with their dealings being listed is extremely flimsy indeed. Likewise, the vignettes recounting the various ways in which scorned lovers have sought revenge against their partners demonstrates how the widespread availability of digital technology has completely altered the ease with which these "you done me wrong" stories can be disseminated, capable of attracting a much wider and more diverse audience. So, for example, that YouTube video that I previously showed was posted by this British actress, and in 6 days it was viewed by over 500,000 people. So now that anyone with access to the internet can air their dirty linen, the capacity to humiliate former partners through widespread adverse publicity is no longer the preserve of high-profile celebrities whose romantic misfortunes attract the attention of journalists. And finally, although my third story involves photography and surveillance of the old-fashioned kind, it's not difficult to see how Mr. Wood's judicial review challenge implicates the millions of CCTV images that are captured every day of people going about their lawful business in the UK, as well as the increasingly broad and powerful array of surveillance technologies that are already in use. Well, I hope by now I've whet your appetite, and on that note, for the analysis, I hand over to my colleague, Roger Brownsville.
Thank you very much. Rachel, do you want to say a word?
Yes. Quick introduction to Professor Brownsword, who's a distinguished academic and record advisor in Parliament as well. He is director of TELOS, the King's College Centre for the Study of Technology, Ethics and Law in Society. He's also honorary professor in law at the University of Sheffield and a member of the Nuffield Council on Bioethics. In recent years, Professor Brownsword has acted as a special advisor to the House of Lords Select Committee on Stem Cell Research, and more recently to the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee for its report on hybrids and chimeras.
Thanks very much indeed, and I must apologise for joining this workshop late on in the afternoon. There are many slides on this PowerPoint that Karen's prepared for me, and I want to just try and say something up front so that you understand what the take-home message is, because it might become a bit of a blur within the time we have available. And there are some truisms that you will say, well, tell us something new. The truisms are, we live in an information society. We've come into this society perhaps without realising that this is what we're getting into. We live in a surveillance society. And when we pause to consider whether we have concerns about the information in the surveillance society, we usually say, yes, we do, because whatever the upside, there are privacy issues associated with this kind of society. So, what's new? Well, what I want to say that I think is new is that regulators, as they try to create a regulatory environment that responds to the concerns we have without killing off the benefits of information and surveillance, have three resources that they characteristically can rely on, three resources which relate to our informational interests, and they are respectively privacy law, confidentiality law, and data protection law. And when people say, oh, well, there's a privacy problem here, they tend often not to discriminate between these three strands, as it were. They don't talk about privacy in a rather specific sense of privacy as against confidentiality, as against data protection. And that's perfectly, you know, perfectly understandable. But as someone who has an interest in the creation of a regulatory environment that I think gets things right and coherent, I believe it's very important indeed that we do get very clearly into focus what privacy is about protecting, what confidentiality is about protecting, and above all in this kind of society, what data protection law is about protecting. Because in all three cases, the law in question, notoriously so I suppose with privacy and confidentiality, was created in a very different world. I mean, privacy and confidentiality law was developed pre the information society. Data protection law was first articulated as we were on the cusp of the information society, but that society has moved on at a rapid pace since the first attempts to put in place data protection provisions were made. So in this presentation, I'd like to try and focus on the suggestion that, focus particularly on data protection, that this particular body of regulation, which is much criticised and I think deeply unpopular in many parts of Europe, rests on a misunderstanding about the nature of rights and consent, which many of the critics of this particular piece of regulation think to be the sources of the problem. And I want to argue, secondly, that as we try to entangle our thinking about, or disentangle our thinking about privacy and data protection and confidentiality, we need to do so in a way that separates out these three strands, privacy, data protection, confidentiality, and then try and explore and get you to think, if you can, about this later in the afternoon, about the appropriate limits of these informational rights. So starting off with the consent as a pivotal feature of data protection and data processing, there are, from many quarters, criticisms targeted at European and UK data protection law. Some of those criticisms are simply about the legal regime now being out of touch with information technology as it lies on the ground. But there are also kind of public interest objections too, particularly from the medical profession, the public health profession, who say that data protection law is interfering with the pursuit of valuable public health epidemiological research, and that we need to revisit the law for that reason. And I think many of these criticisms are well-founded. Lawyers don't like the law because they find it a labyrinth. But the question of whether, or the proposal that we might think about weakening the requirements of consent within the data processing regime as a way of alleviating the problems, I think is a serious mistake. That's not a track that I think we should be going down. So I need to say a few words, and here I hope this will be intelligible, but about how I see consent playing ethically. Consent distinctively belongs within a rights framework of thinking. Consent tends to be unanchored in ethical discourse, but I think when it's correctly anchored, it's anchored to the idea of individual rights, and it's anchored in the way that if I have a right, for example, a privacy right, a right to confidentiality, I can, as a rights holder, authorise acts which would otherwise be a violation of my privacy or confidentiality rights. And you, at least, in acting on that authorisation, would then do no wrong. So consent provides me with a defence, precludes your particular complaint if you act with my consent. However, as a justifying reason, consent is of a strictly limited and rather specific value, because the fact that I authorise your act doesn't mean that it's necessarily right. It means that I cannot complain about your act within the terms of the authorisation that I have given you, but it doesn't mean that the act is right to occur. It doesn't mean, in other words, that some third party would say, oh yes, this is permissible. It's simply between you and me. It's in persona. So consent gives me an answer. It's a very convenient kind of answer as well, because in a world of substantive pluralism where many different people have different views, and in the chamber today, there's a very important debate going on human fertilisation and embryology bill, where there are, of course, a plurality of views about hybrids, about saviour siblings and all the rest of it. And if anyone thinks they can find a position that all substantive constituencies will sign up to, you think that is not the reality. So plan B is to say, make sure you have people's consent. Because if you have people signed up on a consent form, they at least can't complain. So politically and practically, consent plays a very important role. But I believe, nevertheless, that we have seriously overrated and over-egged the idea of consent, because we've gone from thinking that where a rights holder has rights and authorises an action, then consent legitimises, as it were, action within the terms of the consent. We've gone from that, which is acceptable, to believing that if someone out there has a negative view about what I'm doing, I can't possibly justify what I'm doing unless I have their consent. Now, that is not correct. I believe that's a fallacy. It's only correct insofar as those people who have negative attitudes have them under the cover of a right. If you have rights out there that I don't act in a particular way and you object, then okay, I need your consent, other things being equal. But if you don't have rights, then the fact that you don't like what I'm doing doesn't mean that I need your consent. It doesn't mean that without your consent, I must be doing something wrong. So the fallacy of necessity is unfortunately written into much of our thinking about this. On this particular slide, you'll see the famous case of Naomi Campbell and Daily Mirror. You may remember there, Naomi Campbell was photographed as she was leaving a Narcotics Anonymous clinic in London, secretly. Of course, she didn't want the press to publish this story and this photograph. Could the press legitimately go ahead without her consent? Well, on the analysis I've just given you, only if she did have a right to privacy, a right to confidentiality, or a right to something else, that they should not publish and use this photograph. If she didn't have that right, the fact that she didn't like what they were doing would mean that her consent was of no interest. I mean, okay, diplomatically, politely, and all the rest of it, you might think it's a nice thing to do to ask people for their consent. You know, do you mind? Yeah, well, got you. No harm, but as a matter of strict ethics, you don't need to do that. Okay. And the second mistake would be to think that actually, even if there are rights in play, and consent is prima facie required, there may well be exceptional cases where one can justify going ahead against the right holder's interest, notwithstanding their refusal of consent, because you are serving some more important interests elsewhere. So, for example, to go back to the Naomi Campbell case, the press could say that in publishing the story that they published there, they were articulating or relying on the more important value of freedom of expression, their right of freedom of expression, particularly insofar as they were running the story to repudiate Campbell's long-standing claim that she did not have a drug problem. Okay. So if we were now to think about what would make a coherent data protection regime, the European Data Protection Directive and the implementing legislation here in the UK majors on the idea that we are implementing a scheme which is respectful of individual rights, and particularly in Article 1 of the directive, which you have there under the second bullet point, the idea that this is to do with the right of privacy in particular is emphasised. And of course, if it's true, as I think it is, that this regulation does centre on individual rights, then of course consent is going to be a very key element of this regime. The regulation has got outdated back in the 90s when the directive was being agreed. This was in the days still of rather large computers with very visible data controllers. So the whole terminology of the data protection scheme doesn't really fit with small, invisible data controllers, with PCs, with, with a whole raft of now data processing devices which don't look anything like the data processing devices of the 80s and early 90s. In the directive, the cornerstone provisions about fair dealing in relation to personal data in Article 6 and Article 7 lay down some fairly general requirements about fair and accurate processing, about legitimate purposes, and so on. Consent is also part of the mix here, and the member states were given a fairly free rein as to how they would then carry forward those general guiding principles. In the UK, I think in a commendable kind of way, we wanted to try to cross all the T's and dot all the I's, but unfortunately the data protection legislation that we have here in the UK is now totally non-transparent. It's so complex, so difficult, so impenetrable, that no one can really know quite where they stand. And from time to time, we're acutely embarrassed as something happens, allegedly, because data protection law requires it, without it seeming to be a common sense requirement at all. Within this data protection regime, there are, however, three intersecting ideas. These ideas which relate respectively to informational privacy, to personal data, the processing of personal data, and to confidentiality. And the question, the challenge, is whether we can, I repeat, disentangle these three interests in a way that makes coherent regulatory sense, and which does deliver on the ground practical workable solutions. So I'm going to try and just say a few words about each of these three interests, starting with informational privacy, which has a long history, going back to a famous article in the Harvard Law Review in the 1890s by two eminent US lawyers, Samuel Warren and Louis Brandeis. And well, there were personal reasons for these guys wanting to make a case about privacy invasions, and for a while the idea became quite popular that we have a right to be left alone. Privacy became associated with a right to our private space, not a territorial. But then it grows, it develops into the idea that alongside this we have the right to be in control of particular kinds of information about ourselves, about who should know what. This idea of informational privacy is the one that matters for our purposes. I think we can pass over that, actually. The question, though, is how far does informational privacy run? What precisely is the scope of this right? Is it all information about me? Absolutely everything you might know? Well, no, I don't think it is. Characteristically, we think privacy protects a rather special class of information. It's rather problematic to identify what that class is constituted by, but it's narrower than the whole class of information about me. So, for example, I've said on the second bullet point here that, well, of course, it's been said with my consent, that I'm a professor of law at King's College London. But I don't think that if you were to find that out, without my consent, it would be a violation of my privacy. You would find out something about me, but it would only take you 10 seconds on a Google search to find that out. And I don't think that this is a matter of privacy. As I was just walking across from Carlton House Terrace, I bumped into a couple of our first year law students who were celebrating finishing their examinations. I didn't recognise them, I'm ashamed to say. I didn't know them, I mean, there are hundreds of them, and I'd lectured them, but I hadn't had them in classes. Anyway, as I just crossed over into the park, they came up and said, "Oh, Mr. Brownsword. And so now they go away. They go away knowing I was in that area of London today at this time. Is that a violation of my privacy? I didn't say it's okay by me. No, it's not. I don't think so, because this is not intimate or sensitive or special information about myself. Now, there is nevertheless, I think, a class or a category of information which we might think is just our business and no one else's business unless we let them know. Now, it might be a matter of social convention and culture, just where we draw the fence around this ring fence class of information. But I think one challenge for us is to try to work out what precisely it is that we want to protect under the guise of the right of privacy or private information. Okay. And I don't think anybody's quite clear about that. That's, again, more of the same. Now, I would want to distinguish between what I've just said there under the rubric of privacy and the right, let's call it the right to fair processing of personal data. Privacy is an issue that predates the information society, but the right to fair processing of personal data is not something we need to worry about until we get into an information society. But once we're in that kind of society, our personal data, every bit, dot of information about ourselves, is being processed in a digital form, routinely. It's being processed all the time. It's very hard for us to avoid it. And the question here is, where this is going on so routinely, to what extent do we want to defend ourselves or protect ourselves against the processing of this information? It's not, I repeat, so much that someone has this information about you. It's the fact that the information is being processed, and once it gets into the processing system, what can then be done with it? And it seems to me that in the Data Protection Directive, we have a confluence of privacy and data protection without it being clearly taken apart. Now, of course, there are some moves being made, for example, in the recent EU Charter to discriminate explicitly between data protection as an issue and privacy. The examples that that Karen highlighted at the start there, the featured in those vignettes, I think we could run through each of those vignettes and ask ourselves, is privacy implicated here? Are we dealing with that kind of information? Well, the information is being processed. Is there a problem about this? Is there an issue about confidentiality? Confidentiality, I've said nothing at all about really so far. Maybe I should just say there in passing that if I give you some information which you otherwise would not legitimately hold, but I emphasise that this is information that you have in confidence, then I'm signalling that you will do wrong to me if you relay this information to a third party without my authorisation. That's where I think confidentiality kicks in. So what's going on that Evenge site where people are kissing and telling online could well be a breach of confidence, but it rather depends what you think the ground rules are between these now ex-partners at the time they share information with one another, at the time they share their lives, where probably the question of this information going out to third parties is not. Oh, well, there we are, sorry. I've anticipated myself. Sorry, but there is something on the screen there about confidentiality which is trying to summarise what I've just said to you there. Now, if we have privacy, if we have data protection, and if we have confidentiality, a really nice question is, lawyers, when lawyers say it's a nice question, it means it's going to cost you a lot of money to get an opinion on it. And if you're a student, it means never answer a question on that. Okay, but this is a nice question. How precisely do we understand the relationship between privacy, data protection, and confidentiality? How do these rights relate to one another? Rona, who's in the audience here, is a colleague on the Nuffield Council, and I were at a lecture last week given by the chair of the European Group of Experts on Science and Technology, which was about the ranking of values. Now, I think an easy question, if you're talking about the ranking of values or ranking of rights, is the right to life is surely pretty near the top of the list, and privacy is somewhere down the order. If I had to make a choice between privacy and life, I wouldn't find that a difficult choice. Okay, but if you ask me, what's the rank order with privacy, confidentiality, and data protection or data, fair data processing, that's a much more difficult question. Although, yeah, it is a much more difficult question. Although I suppose in saying that privacy protects rather intimate, you know, very close to ourselves, information about ourselves, that sounds, other things being equal, as though it should rank pretty high. When these issues get into the courts, I think our judges tend to be brilliant, but they are, so sometimes prey to slipping from one kind of right to another. And a case that I've just flagged up here is a case called Durant, which people are interested in data processing regard as rather a poor decision, and much criticised, much debated decision. But the point about it that I would just like to flag up here is that the Court of Appeal, when they hear this case, are considering whether the Financial Services Authority have information on file about Mr. Durant, which as a matter of data protection law, they are bound to release to him. And Barclays, who've supplied the information to the FSA, don't want this information being released, and they're arguing the point of confidentiality that they gave the information to the FSA in confidence. In coming to the conclusion that Mr. Durant does not have the right to compel disclosure of more information than the FSA has already released, there seems to me to be a slippage from thinking about this as a data protection issue to thinking about this as a privacy issue. Because the judge seems to, with the judge, Lord Justice Auld, whose judgment is the key judgment in the Court of Appeal, seems to want to say that if the information held by the FSA were of a really important or fundamental nature relative to Mr. Durant's privacy, then this would improve the case for releasing it under data protection law. Well, I think that's completely wrong. The question, I mean, if it's more important, this could well trigger issues about privacy, but I don't think as a matter of data protection law that makes a jot of difference. And there are other examples of this. For example, it's not up on the screen here, but the case where J.K. Rowling was photographed with her husband and young boy on the streets up in Edinburgh, and she brought a claim trying to block the publication of the photograph on the grounds that this would infringe the privacy rights of the young boy of the son, not her J.K. Rowling's privacy interest. Again, I think the court there slips from privacy to data protection without, or the other way. In a sense that, quite plausibly, the judge says, are you seriously saying that someone walking down an Edinburgh street with their husband and their young boy and being photographed in circumstances which do not cause any embarrassment, because it's a perfectly innocent photograph, it's just the family walking down the street, are you seriously saying that raises or engages a privacy issue? No, I don't think it does, in the way I just said that my walking across the park and being spotted by some students and then recognised, I don't think that raises a privacy issue. Okay, but does that mean that there's therefore not a data protection issue? And I want to say, no, I don't think that follows at all. The fact that you say no to privacy does not mean that you have to say no to data protection as well. I think the one doesn't entail the other. These are quite separate matters, because the key about the personal data that's at issue in relation to data protection is that this is data that's now going to be processed, which is susceptible to being profiled and mined and goodness knows what in some you know, high piece of IT kit. Okay, well, there we do have actually the rolling case. And so my conclusion is that with, as a feature of this information society, the vast possibilities to mine this data, joining up databases, carry out profiling and all the rest of it. I mean, this isn't science fiction. This can be done. It is being done. And the question is, what sort of control do we want to have over it? After the Nuffield lecture the other night, we were having dinner and... I don't think Honora would mind me saying this, but Honora O'Neill, who was party to the conversation, said that she makes a point of cutting up her loyalty card at Tesco's or Sainsbury's, wherever it is. She's not going to have anything to do with this kind of thing. Okay, so we're brought into it by the promise of some discounts, but we are trading for that information about our personal shopping habits. And of course, you can see with RFID as well that this can be souped up in a way which tries to think ahead of you. Oh, and incidentally, if I may, that system was not so smart in the supermarket, was it, as to sound alarm bells when that box was left, as the guy does.
That was definitely a
process.
You should have done that far easier if they had set the right reorder quantity on the shelf, but they didn't.
No, I think that's right. There was a case involving Tesco some years ago where they failed to clear a potted yoghurt that had spilled on the floor, which I think a customer had knocked off the shelf and then you know, made off. And someone slipped on the yoghurt and the court held liability on those facts. So if we had a tripping action in that store of the future, I think the customer would be on the winner. Yeah. So in this new world, I think that we want to try very hard indeed to discriminate between the three strands of interest we have, but it's not a simple task. And when Karen and I were at a conference in Edinburgh recently, we had tried just to think what sort of questions we would need to address if we were now to focus very, very hard on data protection and data processing. You know, how anxious are we about what is happening to our personal data in this kind of society, in this kind of context? And on the first bullet point there, these are just questions we don't have answers. Are we worried about people knowing who I am? I mean, in the context of debates about biometrics, people are really quite, you know, they go on about this endlessly. They think we have a right, even in this kind of society, to remain anonymous, I think, to remain invisible. But are we worried about people knowing who we are, where we are, what we're doing, who we're doing it with, and what we like, our preferences in the marketplace? We need to try to identify clearly the relationship between these three informational rights of privacy, confidentiality, fair data processing, rank the rights as between the three of them and relative to other rights. And we need to think about where these rights are being claimed in relation to the state, in relation to commercial parties, in relation to employers or non-commercial, non-state parties. Against whom are we advancing these claims? I can't really improve on that final bullet point, that the scope and strength of these rights is a product of the changing cultural context. This is a digital online world, that's characterised by rapid change, and I'm sure that whatever regulation we put in place that represents a kind of snapshot of what we believe are the rights we should have at a particular time, that will be very soon overtaken by technology, which presents a fresh range of questions. But it doesn't seem to me we've got to first base yet, because we're still thinking in pre-information society terms.
Let me also